Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. An informational curtain is descending on Russia. Against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine, Western media outlets are closing up shop in the country, and Russia's already constrained news and media environment is becoming increasingly unfree. On March 5th, U.S. broadcaster Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, announced that it was suspending its operations inside Russia after local tax authorities initiated bankruptcy proceedings against the agency's Russian office. The new proceedings were the culmination of a long-running campaign against the outlet by the Kremlin that was designed to impede and interrupt its functioning. But RFE is hardly the only Western media outlet to withdraw from Russia. A slew of other print and media sources, from the New York Times to the BBC to Germany's ARD, have all suspended their operations inside Russia. Others, like the Washington Post, have changed the way they operate, hiding sources, obscuring bylines, and the like. Meanwhile, the Kremlin is actively working to tighten its control over the domestic media sphere and to stifle dissenting views and reporting that deviate from the official line. In early March, it passed a draconian new law making it punishable by up to 15 years in prison to disseminate what it considers to be false information about the war in Ukraine. The move has had a predictably chilling effect on what is left of the country's free media, causing journalists to self-censor, sources to clam up, and dissenting views to be drowned out by official Russian disinformation. What does all this mean for the future of media inside Russia? How do we communicate with Russians and Russian speakers moving forward? And how do we reliably keep track of what's happening inside the country now? I asked those questions of Jamie Fly. Jamie is the president and chief executive officer of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, or RFERL for short. It's a post he has held with brief interruption since July of 2019. Before that, Jamie served as a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund and co-director of the fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy. Earlier still, he was counselor for foreign affairs and national security for U.S. Senator Marco Rubio. I interviewed Jamie last August in one of this podcast's earliest episodes about RFE's ongoing problems with Russian authorities. Since then, of course, things have gotten worse, much worse, and I wanted to get his take on what has happened and what comes next for U.S. broadcasting in and toward Russia. Jamie, welcome back, and congrats on the dubious distinction of being our first repeat guest.
Thanks, Ilan. Great to be with you.
Let's start with RFERL's exit from Russia. Your agency has been under pressure from the Kremlin for some time. What's changed now? How did things come to a head? And how did the current conflict play into it?
Yeah, you're right to point out that we have had challenges in Russia for quite some time. Vladimir Putin, early in his tenure, targeted independent media outlets, stripped us of our radio licenses, blocked us from any meaningful access on the TV airwaves inside Russia, and in recent years has used a so-called foreign agent law to target us, to target our journalists, and to try to impose escalating requirements on us as we tried to operate inside Russia. So much so that we were in a legal dispute in recent years, owing more than $13 million to the Kremlin in unpaid fines because of our failure to comply with this law. And then in the wake of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we saw the Kremlin use that outstanding legal fight that we were having, as well as its broader effort to tighten pressure on independent media, to begin the process of forcing us into bankruptcy in Russia, blocking our websites, just as it did many other independent news outlets. So the invasion of Ukraine was really the pretext and the final nail in the coffin of independent media inside Russia. And because of that, we decided to suspend our operations in our Moscow bureau for now, just given the legal issues as well as the growing threat to our journalists.
So the natural question here is, how are you guys adapting? You recently repositioned to the Baltics and you announced the opening of new bureaus in both Latvia and Lithuania. Talk about those changes and what they're intended to accomplish and what other changes might be in the works.
So as we've had this broader challenge of a closing information space inside Russia in recent years, we began to take a number of actions to move some of our journalists outside of the country so they could continue to report and provide programming in Russian for Russian audiences, but do so from safe locations where they could not be harassed by the government. We escalated that in recent weeks, given the Kremlin's latest actions. And so in addition to some of the moves we made last year, we've now decided to set up offices in Latvia and Lithuania. Our Russian hub will really be in Riga, in Latvia. It'll allow them to connect with other independent media outlets that have already set up there and tap into that broader network of Russian nationals who are now working and living outside of the country. It also helped them stay in touch with the diaspora and with people inside Russia, just because of the broader Russian-speaking community that exists in Latvia. Even as we make those personnel moves, though, we're also taking a look at our programming, because things are changing inside Russia as certain avenues to the outside world get cut off. And so we're making sure that we rethink our programming, that we launch new initiatives, new types of reporting that'll be relevant for Russian audiences, even if our reporters are not always there side by side, living next door to them. Topics that we know Russian audiences are still interested in, that we can report on from outside the country. These are all the sorts of initiatives that we're pursuing as we've had to adapt to the new reality inside Russia.
The exodus of Western media outlets from Russia has been mirrored by the shuttering of independent Russian media as well. Today, the Dozhe TV channel has been blocked and closed down by Russian authorities, so has the influential Echo Moskvy radio station. Meanwhile, internet sites like Medusa and MediaZona have been blocked, with access to them restricted for ordinary Russian citizens. What does all this mean for reporting within the country and for our ability to understand what's actually happening there?
I think it's really frightening how quickly the Kremlin, after spending years building up this legal framework where they could target independent media, have now been able to take the final steps to close off access to the outside world. The blocking of websites, the shuttering of several news outlets in short succession, and the demands that they're imposing on those who remain of essentially outright censorship, of saying, you cannot call this a war. You need to call it a special operation. You cannot report on certain things that are happening in Ukraine. I mean, these are the sorts of letters we were receiving prior to the blocking of our websites. They actually asked us to either censor or remove specific articles talking about Russian military casualties in Ukraine, or about the fact that the war actually was happening in parts of Ukraine that the Kremlin denies are even subject to attacks by Russian military forces. So that has all happened relatively quickly, the banning of social media platforms. And it's now reached the point where it's incredibly dangerous for people, either average Russians, to protest against this sort of censorship, and especially for journalists who want to go out and report the truth. They can be charged with treason. They can face charges up to 15 years in prison. And so we are concerned about not just the ability of Russians to access information, but the ability to get information out of the country. The good thing is that we do have technological tools where we can still interact with the audience. They can submit videos and content to us. We can do reporting based on that information that they share with us. We can pair it with other submissions and our own reporting, and then share it back with the Russian audience. And so those are some of the ways that we're going to continue to make sure that we can inform Russians about what is happening in other parts of Russia, and then also help inform the rest of the world about what is going on in modern Russia.
So they say that every crisis is also an opportunity. And I think this holds true for the present situation as well, because what we're seeing on the part of the European Union is a very extensive push to ban Russian state media outlets. The European Union has already banned RT and Sputnik, and the practical effect of that has been to leave most satellite and cable providers without Russian language content. What does that mean for the continent, and how is US broadcasting taking advantage of the vacuum?
Yeah, that's also been a sea change relatively overnight here in the EU, where you had significant market reach of outlets like RT and to a lesser extent Sputnik. And now many countries have banned them outright and removed them from cable packages. And so it's much more difficult to access their content. I think that's progress in terms of pushing back against a lot of Russian disinformation in democracies here in Europe. It's also created an opening because we've been contacted by many cable providers from a variety of countries in recent weeks that are still trying to serve a Russian-speaking audience. And they've actually been asking us to make our 24/7 Russian channel current time available to them. So obviously we're happy to do that. I've also written an open letter to cable providers and others who place channels around Europe, highlighting what we can provide with current time, the news and information that's available for Russian speakers, the cultural programming that we also do. And so we're trying to expand the reach of current time outside of Russia at this moment when there is this demand for quality Russian language content. But also, unfortunately, there are at least, by some estimates, hundreds of thousands of Russians who have left Russia and are now living outside of Russia's borders. We also need to make sure that we're providing them with objective news and information and that they have content that they can tap into wherever they are. And I think current time will be able to play an important role in achieving that goal.
That said, though, Western broadcasting now faces a real problem. Russia is rapidly becoming what you might call a denied environment in informational terms. In light of the current constraints on the media, the new constraints that you talked about, it's unclear whether Radio Free Europe or other outlets are going to be able to engage stringers, to solicit freelancers, or even to pay those people reliably. Can you talk about what all this means as a practical matter for being able to keep track of news and events and political currents within Russia?
So that's where we're going to have to turn to technology to find ways to circumvent the blockages, to communicate with people inside Russia securely and be able to receive information from them. We hope that there's still going to be an ability to do some limited freelance journalism. And we've been able to do some of that in recent weeks, despite the risks. We have brave journalists who have continued to file and to provide us with content. But it's going to be a real challenge because Vladimir Putin's goal is an information blackout, especially when it comes to outside information. He wants to exert complete control over the information space so he can ensure that there's a clearly defined set of parameters about what can and cannot be discussed in public. But we're seeing just in the last several weeks, even though the blocking of our websites is a new phenomenon, we're seeing people adapt. We're seeing people use virtual private networks. We're seeing them use mirror sites, changing URLs that evolve on a regular basis to stay ahead of the blocking. People are still coming to access our content. They're coming to view video about what's going on next door in Ukraine. Actually, earlier today in one of our meetings, some of our staff shared a photo with us that was posted in Russia in a residence highlighting QR codes where you can go get independent Russian news and information that is not censored. And it had the QR codes that took you to the relevant apps or relevant sites for current time, for the Russian service, for Medusa. And so we're seeing more and more Russians adapt to this new reality and still seek out the truth. And so I think that's the optimistic note from the last several weeks, that despite this extreme censorship, people are still hungry for outside news and information. And we just need to make sure that we're able to provide that compelling content and that we can help support them with the technological needs they may have to access it.
This raises the question about new technologies, but also about old technologies, technologies that were used in the past to great effect during the decades of the Cold War to communicate behind the Iron Curtain. Is this a moment where we're going to see a renaissance of these?
I think we need to make sure that we're always able to reach people on whatever platform that is accessible to them. And so our approach in most of the countries we operate, and it's been our approach in Russia for years, even as our audiences have moved online, we've always tried to make sure that we have some radio content available to them. And we're looking at now at possibly expanding that, especially medium wave, which is more accessible to larger segments of the public who have radio receivers in their cars or maybe FM or AM receivers at home. We're looking at shortwave as well, which can reach Russia over longer distances. But the challenge there is an open question about the technology to receive the content and what segment of the population is comfortable dusting off their shortwave receivers that they may have put away in storage years ago and relying on them now on a daily basis to access news and information.
So you raise a good point about the continued primacy of digital media and digital outlets, but those outlets are under tremendous pressure. You see Russian authorities closing down Facebook, closing down Twitter, YouTube, many suspect, is going to be banned shortly. Telegram seems to be the only channel that's still existing, but the communications within it are not secure. Talk about that a little bit. Talk about how the digital media space and the digital information space is changing.
Yeah, it certainly, all of the primary options that were non-indigenous are quickly coming under pressure from the Kremlin. And their goal is to push users inside Russia onto Kremlin-approved platforms. That was certainly the case with Facebook, which the Kremlin could say, well, you have Ikontakia or the Klusky. And as soon as they move people to those platforms, well, what's the next thing that happens? Well, our content and that of other independent outlets is banned by those platforms because they are under extreme direct pressure from the Kremlin, in some cases owned by oligarchs close to the Kremlin. So that is clearly their goal. The good thing, though, is that we still see people using many of these Western social media platforms, but just doing so with a virtual private network. There are many instances now, actually, that are being documented of officials still using their Instagram accounts, even though technically Instagram is blocked. Even Facebook, you know, and Meta being declared an extremist, there are also some reports today that a number of ministries are still using Facebook, despite the fact that the general public's not supposed to be accessing it. So we'll have to see whether that trend continues. But right now, people who have been familiar with those platforms still seem most comfortable coming to those platforms, but just doing so using circumvention technology. And if they use that circumvention technology, they're still able to stream video. They're still able to interact with our content. And we'll have to see whether that trend continues over time.
But this is a dynamic environment. And the digital sphere that you're talking about is likely to become more constrained in the near future. Because for years, the Kremlin has touted the idea of a quote unquote sovereign internet in which Russian websites and online content are disconnected from the broader World Wide Web. Now, it looks like those plans are accelerating against the backdrop of the Ukraine conflict. Russia's deputy digital minister recently ordered Russian websites and online portals to transfer their domains to Russian servers. And now it looks an awful lot like Russian authorities are preparing to sever links to the World Wide Web on a broader scale. Is this the rise of what we've come to call RuNet, the Russian internet? Can they actually do this? And what would it mean as a practical matter?
Yeah, I think this is the truly frightening scenario, which is would even be worse than a lot of the concerning things that we've seen in recent weeks, is if Russia was able to successfully wall off the Russian internet from the global internet in a similar way to what the Chinese have done over time. There were some concerning reports in recent weeks that maybe some of the Western companies that actually provide some of the technical backbone of Russia's connections to the global internet might actually help further the Kremlin's aims by withdrawing from Russia as part of a boycott of Russia due to the invasion of Ukraine. But actually, I think that's incredibly wrongheaded. I think it actually would assist Putin's efforts in Ukraine and his broader efforts to control the debate in Russian society. I think it's important that we in the United States and Europe actually try to promote as many ways to keep the Russian internet connected to the global internet as possible. Because if we do that, then we can allow the use of a lot of these advanced technological tools that I've talked about and deploy it down to the individual level. So people have the power to access the internet without having to go through internet service providers that are under extreme pressure from the Kremlin to restrict the flow of information. I think ultimately that is the best way to ensure that news and information can reach every single Russian, is putting the power of personal internet access separate from any intermediary who can be controlled by a government. Eventually satellite internet, for that to happen, I think right now there have been some trials of that. There's some efforts in Ukraine, for instance, to deploy satellite internet receivers on a large scale to counteract possible outages. There still needs to be work on the subscription model and the price point. But technology like that, I think, is where we should be putting our focus. Ultimately, if we can put that power in the individual news consumer's hands, we can help ensure that the government can never insert themselves between them and outside information.
Well, that's a hopeful note to end on. Jamie, thanks so much for coming back on.
Great. Thanks for having me along.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.